We return to the rebuild of Evangelion this week as the series takes a major departure from the original anime in the latest film by creator Hideaki Anno. Will this ambitious and tricky new direction for that story pay off, or will this mark the downturn for the pillar of the anime universe? Please find out along with us as we 3D animate our way through the third film. This is Kaiju vs. History, Evangelion 3.0. You cannot redo.
Welcome back to Kaiju vs. History. This is your one-eyed, one-horned, flying red angel beater, Miles. And joining me is your glasses-wearing, walking fan service in Ava pilot form, Patrick. Let's be nice to Mari. Come on.
she already has love her all so the much. Fan she needs, Miles. It's so weird, and I'll talk Mari all day long with you, but I've never enjoyed and disliked a character at the same time so much as her for multiple reasons.
I don't dislike her one bit.
Well, it's like they just don't give her a lot. We'll talk about
so they
it.
Don't we'll and I mean this is so I will say this I this is gonna be an interesting movie to do. So will the next one when we get to it next year. We're recording it all one time. This is a movie that I both appreciate and this is a movie that I both appreciate and have a lot of trouble with at the same time. This is such a weird one to talk about because we are talking about Evangelion 3.0. You cannot redo, released November 17th, 2012, into Japanese theaters by the Toei Company. This is the third film in the Evangelion rebuild, or the Shin Evangelion series. Patrick.
This is coming out like almost on the 12-year anniversary. This episode coming out.
That is wild.
I think this is coming out November 11th. So yeah, we're real close.
Before we just get into anything else, Patrick, what if anything is in a title?
Oh, so much, Miles. We talked about the Japanese titles Evangelion Shin Gekko Joban. The subtitle in Japanese for this movie is just Q, as in the Roman letter Q. I guess maybe it's not Roman.
Yeah. No, so that Q, gets used in stuff in a Rome. Lot. They're a kind of anonymous, well, it's not anonymous, but there is a found footage or YouTube anthology that is put on YouTube and also translated simply just called Q.
Well, also Q is a Japanese term used in a lot of different kind of ancient ceremonies and martial arts. And then, like we talked about in the first two rebuild films, this series was meant to follow the Jo-ha-kyu naming convention that pertains to Japanese theater. So the Jo being the Ryzen action, or like kind of the first act,
the three
of the play,
act structure, yeah.
It was the climax, and then Q is
the return
to normalcy, the period after the climax. And in theater terms, I think there's also, it's kind of like a three act structure as well. So for the English title, I think it follows a great parentheses, this being the third film that uses the not in parentheses, making kind of two titles out of one. The Japanese kind of does the same way with the different versions of Q. You know, Q could also be like question or quickening. I think I've seen it also referenced, like the end of the play is the quickening of the play. But
and of course there's the Highlander quickening, which is probably more what they meant.
That's what my brain goes to first.
It's where my brain, when I hear the term quickening, that's exactly what I think about as Highlander.
But yeah, this the English title You Cannot Redo, I think is a pretty good title. Like, you can't go back. You can't
fix
the mistakes that you've already made.
I agree. There is a lot of, I mean, the thematic points in the, not points, but the thematic flow of this movie is consistently about not being able to take back something that has been done. I think that's what's so interesting about the one really interesting thing about this movie is, you know, yes, it completely breaks from the original continuity. This is where things, I mean, there are differences in the last ones. I mean, obviously in the last film, we just get more of a focus on the slice of life stuff. We get to know the characters a little bit better. And there are differences between what happened in the series and what happens in the Shin world. This film, however, I mean, it completely breaks from what happened in the original series, which I love and hate. And it's not because that what I hate is not because it's different. This movie takes place 14 years after the last movie. And
I was not ready for a time jump. I don't think I knew that was going to happen.
So you're not ready for anything that happens, because like, even when you're watching what's going on, the first sequence with Mari and Asuka, you're just like, what is happening?
Mm-hmm.
And then you find out, like, you know, they're in space, they're fighting an angel, but they're also trying to rescue this monolith of sorts.
Mm-hmm.
That we find out has Shinji inside.
Yeah. Why? I don't know if that's ever explained. He's just up there.
No, there is so much. So here's the thing. It's not that I need everything spelled out for me, but there is a, I got to give Ono credit where he's just kind of like, just hear me out. That's the vibe. It's like, just stay with it. And I kind of respect that, that brazenness as a storyteller. Like, no, just keep going. You're fine. I like that. I like the lack of handholding. However, I think in the second half of the rebuild series, I think there is a case to be made that, boy, howdy, I wish these were not two movies, but two seasons of television.
I mean, that's kind of what we get with the final film, because it's like 2.5 hours.
I know it's 2.5 hours, but like,
it feels
and
like
maybe a if
season.
I had 2.5 hours here. Yeah, I'm not trying to project what I'm going to think about in the fourth movie, but like, it's very difficult to talk about both of these movies as separate things, despite the fact they were made like 9 years apart. The storytelling, like in the fourth movie, helps the third movie.
Mm-hmm.
Like they're like, honestly, if you are watching, we chose to release these in the order of release. We had briefly talked about doing all the rebuilds in one go in terms of release structure.
That's a lot of Evangelion back to back
but I would say, and I don't do them one sitting, but I would say if you're going to experience rebuild of Evangelion, I would watch it straight through.
Yeah. It I think it plays pretty well as a season of television, even though in reality people had to wait several years between each of these movies.
The
gap between 3 and 4 is 9 years.
I think I mentioned this in the first episode, but like I remember reading an actually by Heather Ann Campbell, podcaster and writer of Rick and Morty and stuff. She wrote for one of my favorite gaming magazines in the 2000s, Play Magazine. And she was one of their premier anime reviewers because she's super into that stuff. And she wrote the first review, or she wrote a review for the first film. And she was like, this is a shot for shot, you know, remake of the first 6 episodes. So there's nothing new for Evangelion fans, but it's very, very pretty. I would suggest waiting to see what Ono does. And, you know, I kind of took that to heart because I was like, you know what? I had just finished watching the series. I'm like, I'll just wait. And I kind of put it in the back of my head. And then when they announced that 3 plus 1.0 was not only being released, but like, oh, yeah, it's coming to Amazon Prime. That day, I was like, guess what I'm watching?
Yeah, go burning
all
through
4
the
movies.
Yeah, and that's the thing. I'm a huge fan of Patrick Rothfuss and the King Killer yet to be completed trilogy. But
we were talking about this. I think the last time before we were recording was about Patrick Rothfuss.
It's one of those things. It's like, well, yeah, you can wait until he or George R. R. Martin finishes off their series. You might die first, so just read what's out there. If I had known, I probably would have dived into these movies a little bit earlier.
I am perfectly happy experiencing the way that if I had to wait between 3 and 4, 9 years, I would have been driven insane.
Well, because, you know, spoiler warning for this episode, but this one kind of ends on a bit of a cliffhanger.
Yeah, it's super open-ended. I mean, it's open-ended in a good way. Like, I mean,
it's open-ended in like wait until next week to find out what happens, you know, right. Not like wait the majority of a decade.
And it's not wait, 14
until 14 years presidents change.
Right. Like, it's not just that 14 years have passed. Like, this is what's so wild. Not only 14 years have passed, but like everything that you knew about this world has changed. Like
characters have changed, kind of
the sides have changed.
Dichotomy.
You have a whole new group against Nerve. Like,
yeah, whole new universe. And you know, talking about the story, we did talk briefly about the proposed sequel to the Evangelion series that Hideaki Anno was talking about in the 90s, where he kind of proposed an idea about a last walled city after a third impact kind of event, where hundreds of like giant angels roam the outskirts, like trying to threaten to destroy mankind. Which
was it called Attack on Titan?
Which is like a full decade and a half before Attack on Titan came out. But this movie, I don't think it does. It really, it shows the third impact or the second impact or whatever it is in this film.
We see the second impact in the last film, right?
Yeah, so the after effects where all these giants, they're not angels, they're like Evas, like in armor. They're kind of copies of Eva Unit 1 walking around in like this wasteland. So we do get a kind of a version of Attack on Titan in that way. We don't see the last walled city until the fourth film, but it's so fun that he went back to that idea. The idea that wasn't used, or was kind of used in a way, was we talked about Werewolf Asuka.
Oh yeah.
Where they're talking about like having her kind of in like a hybrid form. But at the end of this movie, or the beginning of the next movie, I forget which, she does have her eye is like replaced by an angel part. So she has like an animalistic transformation at the end where she can like
she
merge.
Goes berserk along with the Ava. It's like,
yes. Yeah, so and that's hilariously exactly what Gendo needs in this film to enact another reckoning of sorts, which is
so this is my big problem with and this is with Ava in general, but like this movie just lists off nonsense. Oh yes, according to the Dead Skies Seek Roles and the Path of the One in you know Halloween Resurrection 5. Like they just name things as if we were supposed to know what they are and like with importance. And I look, I don't need like a book Bible, but at the same time, I felt like there were some things that I wish there was just a little bit more meat on the bones in terms of like the world building in that respect, because like they are consistently talking about concepts and stuff. And I love the brazenness of just go with it. But at the same time, I think the storytelling does suffer a little bit because you feel so bogged down with all these terms and made up names for things without any context to what they mean. And so like these characters are reacting, some of them know what they mean. Some of them are like learning what it is for the first time. And I feel like that sort of stuff. I mean, it's something that's been parodied a lot from anime in general. And I think this film in particular is extremely guilty of it. And, you know, both Patrick and I have talked about how we kind of feel this is a weaker entry in some aspects of the four. And I think that's part of it. I think the storytelling suffers from a lot of pomp and circumstance that doesn't feel like anything's really happening, even though things very important are happening. And there's a lot of good things happening here, too.
Yeah. And I have gained a bit more appreciation for this entry after collecting my thoughts, reviewing them, reviews and writings by other folks online. I really have to compare it to the first Rebuild film in You Are Not Alone, the first one, because they are both almost the exact same runtime. They're like just straight up an hour and a half films with like, you know, a little post credits stinger, I think, in each of them. And it's just fascinating what each is able to accomplish and what each fails at in that same amount of time. And whereas the first one is a little bit of a letdown because you've already seen just about everything, and you were kind of hoping that there'd be something a little bit different, get some better action in the film version and then the series. But this one has all the promise of they're finally deviating massive from the series. They're finally going their own direction, and it does
go your own way.
It's good that they do, but I don't think they use the time that they have well enough.
I fully agree. I like the shock that we are in a different circumstance. I love that everything is completely divergent from the original series. I'm actually super into that.
So in 2013, in Otaku Magazine, Aaron Clark wrote a review called Rebuilding Reality on this film, which has some, I thought, a very interesting section that talks about how, unlike the other two movies where you're kind of an omniscient viewer of what is happening in the Evangelion world, like you can bounce between characters, you can kind of hear people's thoughts in some ways, this movie for almost the entirety is really only from Shinji's point of view. It starts with him getting,
which is a bummer,
brought back. Well, it at the very least is
all of my notes are complaining about Shinji.
This is Shinji of old, really kind of wishy-washy. Well, because the one time he made an extremely important decision and he thought he was doing something good, you know, and trying in the last movie to save Rey, he literally like wipes out 99% of the planet Earth. So like, I can understand everyone he once loved hates him as soon as he's brought back to reality here. But it is very interesting that this is almost only from his point of view. I really think for the entire film, maybe towards the end, we get some scenes that don't have him in it, but, and yeah, I thought that was really like, interesting.
My first thought is Shinji is so effing dumb. I can't stand it. His inability to read the room or process what's literally going on in front of him is astounding. That's my first note for this movie.
It is interesting. I
hate him so much.
I think they were really building up his character in that second film to be different from the series Shinji.
And I was so excited for that.
It kind of wipes it out. It goes back to a bit of a zero in this film.
And he stays that way for like,
well, so you can't
the rest of this series until the end.
No, well, he changes pretty well in the fourth film. But I also read something crazy we'll talk about in our next review. But apparently Shinji is like almost entirely silent for the first entire act of part four.
Yeah, and we're all better for it.
Yeah, I mean, until he's shocked out of it by the death of someone that he loves. But yeah, this is a Shinji that is back to work. He has to be in that kind of passive and depressed mode for the character of Kaworu to have kind of a purpose, to kind of bring him out of it. So I understand the peaks and valleys of the character. And
I don't know if that's true. I mean, I certainly think
that was the point of the character in the series, you know, was to kind of make Shinji realize that other people can love him regardless, you know.
Right, without, which is why I don't. I really loved Kaworu in this movie. One, we get more of him than I think we've ever gotten before. We see some of what of his wants and needs. And honestly, I forgot that there is like some weird, like not weird, but there is some legit subtext for like a bisexual relationship for Kaworu and Shinji there. Like,
have you ever seen two straight men duet a piano before? No, it's never happened.
Yes.
Never happened. They have to have some romantic feelings for one another.
No, but there's literally a sequence where like Shinji blushes and when they're talking about each other. And also that whole thing's a date. They're talking about that. Lay out under the stars with me and let's talk about the beauty of what we're seeing. And the whole thing is extremely romantic. And it's honestly a beautiful scene and gorgeously animated. I love this sequence. It's one of my favorite sequences in the movie. Yeah. I think the animation of the piano playing is astounding. I think seeing Shinji sort of come alive for the first time ever, like when he's playing piano, because even at the beginning, he's just like hitting notes like he's a freaking zombie.
Well, it's like, how much time passes when he's at Nerve?
I'm kind of curious about that too, because like all of a sudden it's just like, you he's know, great he's, tickling, at, yes. he's tickling the ivories.
So people have asked that online. It's like, is that just Kwaru's angel power? Is he can like enhance people's abilities and like make them extremely good things? But it also makes me, I mean, we talked about in Death and Rebirth, the framing device of that film, they're all playing cello. And it's like, when do they learn to play these string instruments? I also think
part of it is that Shinji is talented at things. He doesn't allow himself to do things. He's so frozen in himself that he, and I think it's what's so great about this sequence is when he comes out of his shell and isn't such a complete, utter failure of a human being and miserable to be around, and you want to just die if you have to hear him talk one more time. When he's not doing that, like, yeah, he is insightful. He is kind of interesting. And yes, he can do things. And of course, Kwaru absolutely ruins it by being like, oh, yeah, look what you did. see all of the horror outside? Yeah. Did I do this? I'm like, what did he just say?
You caused an apocalypse. What did he just tell you? And it doesn't matter because Rey died and we have a clone of her.
We got a new Rey.
Which just gets thrown in his lap by character.
I think how the Rey stuff is handled in this movie is not good. I don't like it.
Yeah, I'd agree with you there. She gets the character arc I think she deserves in the fourth movie, but here,
yes,
I mean technically she's a new character, so
it's well, the fourth movie we'll get to it, but kind of mirrors a second here. You know, we don't know what happened. We can kind of infer because we had seen, you know, trading out parts and stuff. This rebuild series introduces the idea that Rey is a clone of Shinji's mother, correct? That is a rebuild idea, right?
No, that was in the original series.
Is it not? I always forget. Yeah. I always forget.
Yes. Rey and Nami. And this one, I think Misato gave Shinji that information in the original series or an end of Evangelion, but here it is given to him by Gendo's right hand,
which
man, whose name always escapes
you.
Kozo,
it's something like that.
He's the gray-haired kind of
yes
mentor-esque figure to Gendo, who has
well, yeah, he's trying to get Shinji on his side of things, but like also I think doesn't like he's going along with Gendo's stuff, but like he's like, I want Shinji to make the right choice, not your choice.
He actually has a really interesting character arc over these rebuilds. I don't feel like they ever gave him that much in the original series, but he was always a very interesting kind of enigmatic character. He gets a great scene, I think, with Mari in the fourth film. Mari or Asuka. This
love
movie
Mari so much. I want like a whole like light novel about Mari and like her stuff.
let's talk about her. That's my biggest problem with her is I would love to love her unconditionally, but we're just given so little of her. We get these little chunks. She doesn't even feel like a character in the series. She feels like, you know, someone there for the fan service to sell more toys,
the audience. It's literally why she was put in this movie. But at the same time, there is something there. And again, this is what happens when everyone's like, oh yeah, this is how things are going. I would love, and we get a little bit of it, and we get a little bit more in the next movie, but I would have loved to have a handful of sequences that are not from Shinji's perspective, but like, let's focus on Mari for a little bit. Let's give her at least like, you know, 7 minutes of real screen time that's peppered throughout of her deal, because we're not given enough of that. Like, I mean, they just kind of give you a great design. She's basically like Evangelion's Bayonetta, but like
so close. Yeah.
But I like her and Asuka like being this kind of team. And I love their banter. I think they're great.
Yeah. That's probably
what is Asuka
character,
the four-eyed something.
Yeah,
I can't remember what four-eyed. She calls her four-eyed something, and it's not like four-eyed freak. She just calls her something.
Yeah, it's like four-eyed suck up or butt kisser or something along those
lines.
Yeah,
it's something. It's great.
Mari just kind of takes it.
Asuka's another one who's had a little bit of a disservice in the second, especially in this film, she is just kind of aggro and one note. And
so they kind of bring her character back a little bit more to what the original series character, because the Asuka in part two, in 2.0, was very different from the original series. And we'll find out why, I think, in the fourth movie. We still don't find out here, but in this universe, she is a very different character. She doesn't have the mom issues, because she doesn't have a mom. She's a clone as well. Like,
so Rey, yeah, that's information we get in the next one, which yeah. I got, again, there are things about this movie and this iteration of events that I just don't agree with, even though I will tell anyone my preferred way of experiencing Evangelion is through Rebuild. But there are some deep flaws in this movie. I love all of the moments that, like, Shinji has Kaworu. I like, you know, the stuff with Asuka and Mari. The Rey stuff would only work if you double bill this with the fourth movie. Like, if you're going straight into it and this is like one experience, it works. Mm-hmm. By itself, and especially knowing this is by itself 9 years prior, I don't think it works.
It really does feel like, I feel like parts one and part two are one whole season of the show, and three and four, you know, for better or for worse,
are like both halves of a season.
Yeah, well, I feel like four does feel pretty complete, and because they happen right after one another, they feel like part of the same season, and they're in the same time jump period. But yeah, I'm totally with you. We needed another full half hour minimum of this.
No, I honestly would say we need another hour.
You could do a lot more in that hour, but I both think the characters of Kaworu and Mari needed more time to cook.
And honestly, some of the concepts need more time. Like, they just kind of haphazardly like, oh yeah, I'm the first angel. Sorry, what?
Well, it's one of those things where it is relying on the audience's memory and comprehension of the original series. If you don't have that, then I think you will be a little lost.
Which
in this
I think
series.
Defeats the purpose of this project because
of doing a rebuild. Yes.
Yeah. That's the thing.
Kaworu's character is almost entirely, because technically it is the same character. We will find out in.
They play this idea like, oh yeah, you're basically in a multiverse of madness of sorts.
Well, and they show Kaworu's kind of origin, waking up in like a sarcophagus on the moon where there's like 14 other already opened sarcophaguses there. So it's like, this is a cyclical thing that's happened, and it makes you believe. Oh, and also the first lines he has at the end of part two are, this time I'm going to make Shinji happy. So, you know, playing with the idea that this has already happened again, or happened before, and he's failed to make Shinji happy that time.
It is interesting that this idea comes out post Matrix trilogy.
Right. Yeah. I would say there's a lot of influences here and a lot of things that are influenced by this movie, because I was very interested in this film has a dual plug Eva. We should talk about the Evas in just a minute, but a year before Guillermo del Toro's Pacific Rim came out, where they also had two pilots in one giant
who flat out said what his influences were. Del Toro never shies away from telling you what he loves.
But I will say I think that movie had to have had that idea in advance of him seeing this movie come out, because.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, 100%.
Well, it just, they're both kind of tapping into that same thing.
The synchronization almost, of two people and everything.
At the same time, which is amazing. I'm sure they probably talked in maybe very broken English. I don't think either of them speaks very great English at this time, but.
I mean, Guillermo did.
Guillermo was very, very fluent at this time. This is 2012, right? So
yeah, he had made several English language movies by this point.
Yeah, let's talk about the Evas, because we do have both very interesting looking and very confusing Evas in this movie. We get a good look at, because I don't think Unit 8 was in the second one. Mari doesn't have her own EVA in the second film, right? She's only piloting.
You don't. Asuka's. Yeah, you never see her in an EVA. You know that. Doesn't she pilot the one at the beginning?
She pilots Asuka's in part two. And oh yeah, she also pilots the one at the very beginning of part two that gets destroyed. But
so we know she's an EVA pilot, you know.
Unit 8 is her EVA, and it's pink, which is fine, you know.
It's cool. I like Unit 8.
It's I don't think you have to wear the same plug suit as your EVA color, but she does. So does Asuka, so it's like whatever, but
yeah, I mean exactly.
I found it interesting, one of the first designs for Unit 8 was kind of, I would say, a more classic EVA looking design. It looked more like Unit 1, but was also designed originally to have a dual plug system. They scrapped that early on because they knew they were going to do that for Evangelion 13, which we'll talk about. But, you know, we're not what plot point that would have served. Would Mari and Asuka pilot one EVA if that was going to happen? We don't know. Evangelion 13, I dislike, Miles. Do you know what? Do you even remember what Evangelion 13 is?
Yes.
It's the one that Shinji and Kaworu pilot, and it looks exactly like
Unit 1.
But Unit 1, EVA 1, is now used as the core of the ship known as the Wonder, the ship that Captain Misato? No. She captain in that movie? I mean, she's captain of the ship.
No, but they call isn't she like corporal or general?
Oh, yes. Maybe admiral?
She's not an admiral. But she's not a captain. She was captain prior, wasn't she?
I was about to say, well, in the original series, she was Captain Katsuragi. But yeah, she has a different rank here. She's in a different organization completely. And I don't like the Wonder. I don't think it's a great like kind of anime ship.
The Wonder.
The Wonder.
Yeah, because their name is Villa, but it's spelled Billy.
Billy. Willie. It's Wally. That's a Metal Gear Solid style naming.
It really is, which I mean, that does not surprise me. if Anno is you know referencing Kojima, that makes all the sense in the world. Those two go hand, they're like peanut butter and chocolate, you know.
Yeah, I was kind of hoping that the ship would transform into like a giant ship style EVA. I do like.
I kind of wanted the Wonder to be more like a kind of a Macross situation.
Yeah, I mean it kind of is. It's like a platform.
Yeah, but it doesn't transform.
Oh no, it doesn't.
Which is what we're talking about.
It does have ships that like attach to it, like giant floating aircraft carriers. Yeah. I think.
I here's the thing. I think the Wonder is an interesting concept that isn't quite there. Like there are like it feels like it's the concept art for the better idea.
Yeah it's a little difficult to look at and be like, what is that? Is that
I love the idea that it's using the carcass of Unit 1 as a power cell, and there's a lot of cool stuff about it, but it just kind of looks busted.
We get a ton of new characters because 14 years have passed, both characters that were like, I mean, one that we never met before this and like grew up, became members of the deck crew, as well as some new characters here and there. Maya Ibuki, I think, is the like pink haired crew member. And I only mention her because we're going to talk about her when we talk about the fourth movie. She has her own. No, that's not right. Not Maya. She's another member. Who's the pink haired one?
I can't remember her name, but I know exactly what you're talking about. Because that was the thing, is a lot of the new characters, I don't remember their names.
Well, in this movie, they have like maybe five minutes. Gosh, there are so many characters like in total in this film. I have to look it up now or I'll go absolutely crazy, Miles. maybe I can talk about some of the other characters. We got Sakura is a character in this film, and she is Toji's younger sister. So she's the sister that Toji originally punches Shinji in the first series and the first film because she got hurt in an Eva attack. So we actually get her as a, you know, I guess an adult character. You know, she's got to be in her probably 20s at this point. So I really did enjoy that. And she has, you know, agency and something to do in the fourth movie as well. She comes back. Gosh, why can't I find this character? Killing me. Midori Kitakami is one of the bridge crew. And I really liked her character design. I thought when they make a character that looks like this, they will give her more things to do. And technically they do. She gets her own origin story, like a little short film called Evangelion 3.0 minus 46 hours.
What in the Kingdom Hearts is that name?
Yeah, it came out 2 years after the fourth movie released, and it's pretty long. It's like 10 minutes, and it's talking about her origin. It's like, why couldn't we have gotten that for Mark?
I mean, that's the thing, is like there's a lot of stuff that, because I feel like we're having a conversation about both these movies, even though we're not talking a ton about what happens in the fourth movie. And again, this is what's so difficult about talking about the second half of Rebuild, is I feel like more so than the first one, the first two, these movies really go hand in hand. And like the first 3.0 almost feels like Fire Walk With Me. Like, it feels like a prequel that, like, it's kind of necessary for information wise, but like, you kind of don't need to watch it either. It's really weird because, like, I could probably skip and get a 15 minute, like, yeah, it's 14 years in the future and some stuff happened and that's it. Like, it's, and I hate saying that because there's good stuff in this movie.
But there's a lot of rehash too. Like, I don't think we get anything super different from the Kwaru Shinji relationship of the series. And if you have the length of a movie to re-explore that, I really wish they had done a lot more. We do get, instead of Shinji having to kill Kwaru, we get Kwaru kind of realizing he is going to sacrifice himself instead of Shinji. But in both instances, he dies. So like, the end result is kind of the same. And I guess Shinji is equally scarred in both deaths.
But, oh yeah, I mean, it goes back to being the catatonic "I'm not talking" Shinji.
Yes. Well, I mean, he just solved. I'd be pretty messed up if your head exploded.
Yeah, I get that, but like, at the same time, like, we've already seen that he's an insufferable person. Like, this old chestnut.
Yeah.
Which is exactly how Asuka treats him, then deservedly so.
I actually think Kwaru works better in the original series than here, because the original series
disagree, but I also asterisk that with, conceptually, I think he works better here, but with what we get.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. It is so dependent on already understanding his and Shinji's relationship, because you're not expected to know what is going on with him when you watch the television show for the first time. And here, you are expected already to have done some homework.
Which is, again, this is an issue for me. I don't know if that was necessarily his intention. It's just how it ended up, where like, this works if you know Evangelion.
Yeah, it's hard to just throw out everything from the show and kind of try and do it from scratch. So I can understand why, but he does kind of throw out the book in the second and fourth movies and builds up characters from the ground up. So I kind of wish we had gotten the same, like I said, some more time for that character in this movie. Do you have a favorite scene or favorite part of this film?
I mean, I mentioned call a spade a spade. I like the date between Kaoru and Shinji. I think that scene is excellent. I love there's not a whole lot of kaiju action in this film. This is pretty devoid of that. I mean, we get some fun stuff with Mari and Asuka at the beginning, which I love. Anytime Mari's on screen, thumbs up.
The angels that inhabit this new world are just like gnats, you know? There's just like hundreds of them that attack the Wille and Nerve at the same time. And then we get a like an Angel 13 at the end of the movie that gets released, and it's just CGI. It's
very boring. Was Angel 13 though, isn't he?
Or maybe it's, I'm not sure the designation.
The numeration is infuriating. So
what's well, so different between the series and this? No, the angel that gets released when they pull the spears out of the giant god's back in the movie. But it just kind of looks like a bunch of CGI weird snakes attacking them. It's probably one of the least impressive of the new angels that they've added into this series, new and changed ones. My favorite scene, there's a big action sequence to kind of start this film, but then once Shinji kind of realized what's happened and realized all these people, because he tried to save Rei and it backfired, he's fitted with that explosive collar, Sato's fingers on the trigger, and then we get a scene where the person that he was told died comes to rescue him. Rei like literally punches a hole through the side of the Wunder and puts a hand out of her Eva unit for him to climb onto. And yeah, I really liked his escape from Wille and Masato like nearly ready to blow the collar, but you know, we obviously know.
Yeah, that's a cool moment that she like, but again, I wish there was some sort of OVA or something that came out later or something that kind of details some of the 14 years prior. Yeah. Because like, it's one thing to have a time jump and to have a mystery, like a lot of shows do that. It's another to like just flat out, yeah, 14 years passed, and if you ever want to know what happened those 14 years, tough titties, you know? Like, because especially for like Masato to get to where she is, and like for Shinji to be consistently threatened, like he must not pilot an Eva. And we're not entirely given a full reason why. And the end kind of is like, oh, wait, it's because like he's actually perfectly synced. That's why it looks so off. And like there's some nonsense in this film that just doesn't quite work for me. And there's some nonsense that does. And I think just having, honestly, not just explanations, fleshing out some of these ideas. This movie is short and the next one's like 2.5 hours. And this is why I had the you know, thought that I wish these two rebuild movies were two seasons of television, because like, I feel like if we had 10, 25 minute episodes, we could fill all this out appropriately and just nail it.
Why I think the series works so well is the episodes do have these giant kaiju battles, these very elaborate animation sequences, but they are built around these characters having to work together, having to have the, you know, the relationships grow between them. And the movies almost never get that right. I think 2 and 4 have sections where
I think 2 gets it right.
Yeah, the main three characters of Asuka, Rei, and Shinji do get that time, but that's all over the series. You know, just some of my favorite episodes are about their dynamic and how much they care about each other. And that's why I think the series worked as well as it did. And these movies kind of cash in on people already caring about those same characters.
I just never care for the second half of the series, and End of Evangelion is a very, very solid film, but like
it's a masterpiece.
There is something that's just never quite sat right with me about the series. So I like redoing a lot of it, and certainly this gets course corrected. But yeah, for me, this movie's it's a little bit of a bitter pill to swallow, because it works after the fact, but on standing on its own, I don't think it does, which I guess we should get to our ratings.
I mean, first off, the critics agree with you. This has a 6.9 out of 10 stars on IMDb. Nice. Very few. Actually, I don't think there are any reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. Maybe they are expunged because I've seen references to them, but no critic reviews on Rotten Tomatoes. And it only has a 65% from fans there. Metacritic critic score is 45%. It's the lowest of the series, but this has the same score on Letterboxd as the first film, 3.7 stars out of 5. And honestly, my scores are pretty similar. This movie did get, you know, when it was purchased by Amazon, re-releases in the DVD Blu-ray that came out in 2016 was 3.33. We talked about how they named the for the releases differently, and then they announced a limited run before the fourth movie came out of this film, and that was Evangelion 3.333. I wanted to get that in there. I didn't mention that in the title.
I do love the 3.33.
It is interesting that this movie got a lot of different releases and some things changed up. But for my personal enjoyment, Miles, this I think is definitely my least favorite of the rebuild films. I put it down there with the first one because the first one just doesn't give you a lot more than what the show would give you. But it's for a number of reasons. I think the pacing is off here. It feels more like just a long episode of the TV series than it does a film, because you're right, it is there's not a lot of action. There's really maybe two episodes, whereas the first movie is like a full 6 episodes.
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem of this movie is because of the time jump, because of all the new characters, there's so much lore dump that they have to do at the beginning of this film. And it's not something this universe has been very good at, because it's so complicated to begin with. And while this film is the wildest departure from the original series, this has like almost no slice of life. So they try to set up these very important action sequences where, like, you know, Asaka is taken out and things like that. But the weight of the battles, the kaiju battles in the series, is dependent on the characters' connections to one another. And at this point, like, everyone hates Shinji except Mari. Mari seems to be perfectly fine with them at all times, but it just takes me out a little bit. So my personal enjoyment for this one, Miles, is 7 out of 10. It is it's fairly low. What about you?
I am boy. I think there are a lot of interesting ideas at work in this. I love that it's a swerve. I love that it kind of takes you for a ride. But I think that ride needs work. And despite the fact that there are some great moments, there's some great animation, Mari's here, I think a lot of it just needs fleshing out. And like, a lot of the things I appreciate about it come from the fact that the fourth movie exists. So in that, it's tough because, mm-hmm. you know, the production is wonderful. It's a great looking anime. It's well acted. It functions. And I honestly like the ending of them kind of like having to fend for themselves and walk off into the unknown.
I mean, honestly, it felt very much like the ending of Empire Strikes Back. So I did love that. I love that it's kind of like a open ended and a bit of a bummer.
Yeah, I mean, well, it's Evangelion. Everything's got a bit of a bummer, dude. But there is 100% like, there are great ideas. And again, this is a 7 out of 10. This we ain't exactly like duking on this movie. A 7 out of 10 is a very good score. It's a good movie, and that score reflects that. However, there are a lot of disappointing things, especially considering the superlative nature of some of the other films and entries in this franchise, as well as the esteem this franchise holds. So it does kind of stick out like a sore thumb in that respect. It's a movie that I get softer on each time I rewatch it, and the more I rewatch Rebuild in general, because I think there's a forgiveness of some of the nonsense that happens and some of the nonsense terms that are thrown at you. You know, through rewatching things, you catch more. You can kind of like let some of the stuff kind of sink into your brain so that some of it sounds less like absolute hogwash. It's a good movie, but that's it.
Yeah. What about for your technical assessment of this one? Leaps and bounds there from parts 1 and 2?
Yeah. So the technical aspect, I mean, it looks really, really good. This is a good looking. The sequence when Koharu and Shinji are on that walkway outside of the walled city and looking mm-hmm. onto the devastation. I mean, just flat out stunning. I initially gave this a 9, but I'm actually, the more I've talked about that, I think the script knocks it back to an 8. Because the script, and because if it wasn't, if the script was on par, this could have been a 10 in this respect, because this movie looks incredible. This movie's well acted. Everything about this movie works except that script. So I like the designs of the new mechs. I think some of the creatures that we do see are pretty cool. The final battle with all of the Evas is very well choreographed, ruined entirely by Shinji being an idiot. But yeah, I think with a better script, this could have easily been a 9 or 10 in the technical aspect. But yeah, that script really hurts this movie, because there is the fact that this movie can't stand on its own two legs. It severely hurts it. Whereas like 2 absolutely can. 1, of course it can, because it's, you know, a remake of the first 6 episodes. But this one, like, it's not, I want to be clear, it's not because it does a time jump that has some bunch of bold new ideas. Those are the things I love about the movie. It's the fact that it doesn't fully commit to all those bold new ideas, doesn't flesh them out. It kind of just takes you for a short ride. And if this script had been punched up, or this movie was 30 to 60 minutes longer, I think we would have had, honestly, a golden film on our hands. But as it is, yeah, I got to stick with an 8.
Yeah, I'm right there with you on this one as well. I think this is technically the weakest, mostly because of the writing of the series. But also, I think some of the 3D animation, it just doesn't have the weight of the standard kind of ground battles that we've had in the other two films, than the series. It also feels a little more incongruous than the 2D animation in parts, because there's a lot of heavy reliance on it towards the end. A problem that gets solved in the 4th movie, in my opinion. But yeah, the other thing is, this just feels like maybe a couple films smushed together in a few places. The editing feels a little out of whack. It is quite a choice to change the time frame 14 years, jump ahead 14 years, but also make it so the Eva pilots don't age. And we know exactly what you're doing, Hideaki Anno. Mm-hmm. So yeah, Asuka is does not act like a 30-year-old woman in this film. She looks and acts still like a 16-year-old. But yeah, besides the time jump, some of the problems with the scripts, I didn't feel like we got enough time to acclimate to this new world before there was another, you know, world-ending event in the third act of the movie. And yeah, at the shortest or second shortest of this series, I feel like this one needed to be the dark middle chapter that really expanded on the lore, the characters, and everything, and we just didn't get it. So 8 out of 10 is still great, I think, on our scale. It is still very, very good in a lot of ways, but in a lot of ways it had to be perfect. It did not. And I'm giving it a very similar score for where I think its importance is in all of kaiju films, but also in the Eva series. It is different enough from the rest of the films that, with the, you know, the time skip and what have you, that it is refreshing that we are not getting a lot of rehash material in this movie, except for Kwaru's and Shinji's relationship. I feel it's like the exact same, but I feel like a lot of this movie could have just been divided between the second film, like happened at the end of the second film, or tacked on to the third film. Like, it just doesn't have its own place in this series. I think some of the time could have been used to give more of an introduction to Mari Illustrious Makanami.
I mean, no argument there.
Given her a little bit more in part 2 would have also been nice. But yeah, Shinji really didn't need to have a longer relationship with Kwaru as well, I think, in the entire series. I think he should have been introduced in part 2. Like, he should have been another pilot that gets added into the slice of life stuff, you know? So yeah, I'm giving this an 8 out of 10 for its importance as well. What about you, Miles?
Man, this one's tough for me. I I think I am going to stick with a 7.
Okay.
I go back and forth between 7 and 8. But with it in its current state, if there was something, if we all of a sudden found out, oh no, there's a 3.33 repeating version that's got like, you know, at least an extra 15 minutes that does something, I could be, you know, that could completely affect how I feel about this movie. This is a movie that like I'm always going to watch if I'm watching Rebuild, but I'm gonna be like, all right, let's buckle in.
Let's eat our vegetables before we get to dessert.
Right. And I don't think it's really, yes, there is some psychobabble and some jargon stuff that people love to eat up, but I don't even think it does that stuff as well as, you know, even the fourth film or the first two. I think it does that, but it does that in addition to throwing people in a brand new situation, and it makes it just things seem like things are being just like spit into the void. And in terms of kaiju cinema, well, there's not really much kaiju to fight. There's some cool robots, but yeah, I think this is, again, this is a fine film. It's a very deeply flawed film, but definitely worth seeing. It should not be forgotten. Obviously won't be because it's part of massive franchise, but yeah, I would say it's the weakest of the bunch.
Yeah. So that puts me at a very soft 8 and you at a bit of a harder 7, but it's so funny that you mentioned a 0.333 repeating version of the film, because you're at a 7.33 repeating and I'm at 7.6. Averaging it together, it means our podcast final for Evangelion 3.0, You Cannot Redo, is a 7 out of 10.
I'm happy with that.
I mean, it's honestly, I think, probably where it should be. That is still a very good.
Yes, still a very good film. And it is a good film. It really is.
But rightfully so, is probably at the bottom, I think, of scores of all of our EVA films outside of Death and Rebirth, which got a 6. So,
yeah. The thing is, someone just gave me this bomb homemade burger with some of the best ingredients you can get. And then someone just delivered me a very solid McDonald's burger.
Mm-hmm.
And like, yeah, it's good for what it is, but it ain't this good, you know? Well,
don't you worry, because next year we're getting a big old steak basically by comparison, I think, in this analogy, Miles.
Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah. So, wow, we're going to talk about it like almost immediately after we get done episode. Yeah. The next part is not out until 2025. I think this a little later or earlier in the fall next year, because it took 9 years for the actual fourth Evangelion Rebuild film to come out. But yeah, the 3.0 You Cannot Redo is getting a 7 from us. Miles, where can folks talk to us about their love of Evangelion, their appreciation for all things kaiju online?
Well, you can email us at kaijuversushistory@gmail.com. You can go to us on Twitter, X, whatever they're calling it, at Kaiju Versus History. Visit our website, kaijuversushistory.com. But if you really want to talk to us about all things kaiju, you go to cosmiccrit.com. You hit on that Discord button. There is a Cosmic Crit channel. I mean, there is a Kaiju Versus History channel within the Cosmic Crit Discord. We are on there almost every single day, bored at work. We'd love to talk to you.
So much kaiju news to talk about.
There is so much stuff on there. And also great people to talk to. Very, very fun time.
Yeah, fans hang out there. They chat about the movie of the week every once in a while.
And watch and along with us. I am always talking about Power Rangers or Super Sentai with somebody. Otherwise, rate, review, comment on our show, share with your friends, let us know what you think. Check out our Letterboxd account to see our reviews and our watch list of films. Patrick, what are we doing next week?
Thank you, Miles. Thank you, listeners. Thank you, everyone out there. We're going to catch you next time when we take a look at one of the few non-Godzilla kaiju films to grace the Criterion Collection, this time by legendary artist and first-time director Takashi Murakami. Is a very weird post-Fukushima world that is inhabited by Pokemon-like creatures and one gigantic monster. That's right. Tune in next time for History versus Jellyfish Eyes.